2005 Sunstone Symposium West presents Session 54, LDS Perspectives on the Stem Cell Debate, a discussion led by David Hunter.
Well, I'd like to welcome you to our discussion on stem cell research. The first requirement is you turn off your cell phone. I could have said something more clever. I remember hearing what stations or what different organizations were doing to get people to turn off their cell phone. And there was one, an orchestra in one of the East that was had some interesting approaches, but I can't remember what it was. Well, this is a timely program for us in light of the fact that we have the stem cell initiative. And so in trying to educate myself, I went on the internet to get a little better understanding of the issues. And I come across one aspect, and that is, this is a series of articles on different issues on stem cell basics, published by the National Institutes of Health. And it makes this one major point: studies of human embryonic stem cells may yield information about the complex events that occur during human development. The primary goal of this work is to identify how undifferentiated cells become differentiated. And the question in my mind, how can we do that if we're not working with embryonic stem cells? And so with that introduction, I'll turn it over to you.
First of all, a little truth in advertising. I'm not an ethicist, I'm not a theologian, and I don't do research in stem cell projects. But I'm an obstetrician gynecologist, so I'm on the perimeter of this field in all those aspects all the time. And I think that my experience can try to bring those fields together. When Dan asked me to speak, I was very happy because I gave a beta version of this in Seattle last fall. But I forgot a critical connection between my computer and the LCD, and so I couldn't use my PowerPoint presentation. So I said, great, Dan, I've got it all ready. This would be wonderful. And then I thought, well, I don't know. If you've been through a political campaign where this is a major issue, you may not really be interested in it, or you may know more than I do because you've been involved in it. So for a minute, I thought, well, maybe I should think about other topics I could give. And so I did some brainstorming, and this is what I came up with. I'd like to be the privatization of Social Security, good news or bad, the United Order. This is a real episode. This is a real issue. There's a Mennonite or a quasi-Mennonite group in Montana that is trying to get some individuals on Medicare. And the government says, no, the individuals may be poor, but the community is rich. And the government is fighting, and they're in court right now with this. So it's a real issue. But it's an issue for them, but me, not for us. So then I thought, I don't know how much this is Stanford land, but for those of you who know, Charles Sumner thinks that women have as much place in science as the Mormon Church thinks women have in the priesthood. And Harvard Hall, John Harvard Hall and Kirtland Temple, pretty similar, Now, this has been done before, and I think we ought to give the Book of Mormon a rest, okay? So I eliminated that. I want to be competent, taking a cue from our president to err on the side of life. We have to consider that in all parts of our life. But then I decided, no, we need a panel discussion. I'd much rather moderate a panel discussion than to give a talk. So I made some contacts. I had three people that would be willing to talk about their Hollywood experience with religion in the workplace. Now, 10 or 20 years ago, we didn't talk about religion in the workplace. Right? You didn't talk about religion. Well, now it's much more open. Unfortunately, at the last minute, these three panelists just couldn't show up, and I felt very bad. It would have been a great discussion. Gladys Knight, Tom Cruise, and Mel Gibson would have been a firing debate. But this week gives us a new option. A German apostle, a German pope, why don't we trust Latinos? And actually, I think this is a serious topic. But don't have time. So back to the original. The Ethics of Stem Cell Research. But this is not the right title, because it's not really the ethics of stem cell research. It's the ethics of embryonic stem cell research. And that's a big difference, and we'll get into that as time goes on. Nobody objects to stem cell research. It's using embryos as the source of the stem cells. That's the issue. I decided to divide up this talk in like a university. This is the Signe Rignan University of Speculative Theology. So we're going to do that way just to help organize things. And so we're going to talk about basic cell biology first. I'll run through it because we have to all agree that we're on the same page here. With the notable exception of red blood cells, functioning cells contain a nucleus. Each nucleus has a complete set of DNA. Germ cells, also known as zygotes, sperm and oocyte, contain a single set of DNA, all others a double set. And DNA, of course, contains all the information needed to create a new body. All cells have it. All cells have the DNA. This picture shows a chromosome, which coiled strands of the DNA, just as a representative, not as a real picture. I've taken this liver cell with black marks to indicate those parts of that chromosome that are turned off, or turned on, let's say turned on. In the nerve cell, different other parts are turned on. And whether those switches are on or off makes all the difference, whether it's the liver cell or nerve cell or skin cell. So and mature, or also known as somatic cells, differ from physical characteristics and function because different parts of the DNA are permanently switched on or off. Stem cells are immature cells. In these cells, the switches are open, waiting for external or internal triggers to turn the switches on or off. These external triggers may be chemicals, nutrients in the environment, what's going on next door. They can be internal triggers within the own the DNA itself. And as you might imagine, terribly complex. The basic, the bottom line for immature stem cells, or immature or stem cells, they're non-functioning. They don't produce hormones. They don't stretch. They don't conduct electricity. They're non-functioning. But they are self-renewing. When they divide, they can remain stem cells, so the daughter cells can be stem cells, or the daughter cells can become cells with specialized function based on these internal and external triggers. Now think of stem cells like a medical student or resident. Basically non-functioning, but with the ability to become psychiatrists, family practice doctors, surgeons, or forensic pathologists. Totally different in the end, but they all start out these same immature cells. Two types of stem cells, adult stem cells or embryonic stem cells. To talk just for a minute about adult stem cells, we can think of them coming from a couple of places. Mostly we think of the bone marrow. The bone marrow contains lots of stem cells, not just for blood cells, but for what's called mesenchymal stem cells, which can become blood vessels or muscles, for example. The hematopoietic stem cells become white blood cells, red blood cells, or platelets. And this is a good representation of how diverse the specialization can be. So this one stem cell, that's a hematopoietic stem cell, can create really totally different types of cells. Umbilical cord is the other source of adult stem cells, and you have to be careful here. You think, well, that's not adult, but just that's how it's defined. So adult stem cells are also found in umbilical cord. Out of every 10,000 blood cells in an umbilical sample, one will be a stem cell, and that's actually pretty good. Now we're moving on to our next class, embryology 321, to get some of the basic factors of that. With conception, the sperm penetrates the oocyte. The oocyte wall immediately becomes impervious to penetration by other sperm. The now fertilized egg is known as a zygote. Within 90 minutes or so, the zygote has started its first cleavage, its first division, which ends with two identical cells. Now, this is a slide that I'm just going to touch on, a very complex, but I have to put it in. you can call it imprinting, similar, other authors would call it epigenetic memory. And to begin with, if you're very superficial, you think, well, maternal DNA plus paternal DNA should equal human life, but that's not the case. There's a black box here. It takes more than just the DNA. That black box is referred to as imprinting, or a memory of what's gone on during the development of the sperm and the oocyte in their own particular environment. Some of these triggers we talked about. So it's important to realize there's this black box. You just don't put mom and dad's DNA together and come up with a baby. There's a lot going on, which is why it makes cloning so difficult. Successful cloning is maybe centuries away. They cloned the lamb Dolly, but Dolly wasn't normal. And most cloned attempts at cloning are not normal, don't survive at all. So that's just a warning that there's this black box out there. Now, milestones are important to know and become very important in the stem cell debate. Maybe a little too important, and well, at the very end, I'll tell you why I think it's too important. Day 3 is what this embryo looks like, or blastocyst, what we call it. There's an inner cell mass, those are the stem cells, and the outer cell mass, or outer cells, called the trophoblast, that eventually is going to become the placenta. But then this will become the embryo and fetus. But all these cells in this inner part are all the same. They're all identical. Who knows? Maybe a week after conception, the embryo is implanted in the wall of the uterus. About 2 weeks after conception is a process called gastrulation, and we'll talk about it on the next slide. 40 days, a primitive heart can be seen. 50 days, a motion can be seen on ultrasound. 150 days or 24 weeks is when the embryo, or the female fetus, we call it, has a 25 to 50% chance of survival if it's born. Although I'm not saying survival normal, survival usually with major problems, but the living. Now, gastrulation, also known as individuation, is at this point that all cells are no longer alike. Before this stage, all the stem cells, all the cells in the blast are just the same. But now we first have a differentiation. They become different from each other, eventually on their way to becoming all the 200 or so cell types in the body. Also at this stage, separated twins are no longer possible. And for some ethicists, that's a real important adjunction, because it means that this is truly unique. It wasn't unique before because it could always become twins.
Does that mean at that point, if you don't have twins, you don't get them?
Well, after this point, you have the Siamese twins, the conjoined twins. But the normal separate individual twins has to occur before this day 14 or so.
At what point are conjoined twins no longer possible?
I don't know. So, once again, more pictures. Embryonic stem cells, day 4, all cells are alike. Day 14, the cells are now becoming to be different. Now we go into our next class, our summer research program in stem cells. Transplantation is what we normally think of as the way to replace or repair diseased organs, but with significant risk of surgery, rejection, immune by the immune response. And of course, you can't, some organs just can't be transplanted, brains. And others are very difficult to transplant. Stem cells offer the potential for regeneration of abnormal absent tissue, but with much fewer risks. So the goal or the theory is that stem cells will replace transplantations. Maybe not in time, maybe going too far, but certainly they'll give a lot more options. Mainly because there's only so many transplantable organs around. There's a huge shortage of it. And stem cells may solve that problem of shortages.
How is rejection for stem cells?
It's really
Well, that's an issue, but can be resolved. If you obtain the stem cells from the donor, so they're the same cells, they're not foreign, nothing different. But it is a big issue. Now, I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about the different parts, the different research. It's changing a lot. But just to give it a broad overview, leukemia, that's the standard. Patients with white blood cell cancer, they're given a poison that kills all their blood cells, cancer and everything, good and bad. Then bone marrow cells are put into their system, which hopefully will contain stem cells that will divide and grow and replace the blood cells. Has a lot of problems with, since these bone marrow cells are obtained from another source, you have the immune rejection problem. Central nervous system, a lot of work on that. Spinal cord accidents, if you could just grow some new nerve cells where that transection took place, that would be great. Parkinson's disease, nerve cells don't make dopamine. You can take dopamine as a pill, but it's hard to get in the brain where it needs to go. Just give them the cells and make it own dopamine. Alzheimer's, multiple sclerosis, brain cells die. Why not make new ones, replace the problem? Diabetes, pancreas cells don't make insulin. Can you just put new stem cells in the pancreas, let them make their own insulin? Would be great. Sounds great. Heart disease, with a heart attack, muscle cells die in the heart, but stem cells can be put into the heart and grow new muscle cells. They've done this with mice, and they've done some experiments with human volunteers. Not great results so far. They show in these heart attack patients that their functional improvement, their ability to move and to the efficiency of the heart increases by 5 or 10%. That doesn't sound like a lot, but all the research subjects are very, very sick people in the first place, so they wouldn't be on these protocols. So for them, 5 or 10% improvement can be the difference between being able to get out of bed or not. So a lot of promise there. So great promise everywhere, but a lot of work left. It's interesting, the scientist that does a lot of work on his heart has been criticized because he doesn't understand why it works. He just basically takes a syringe full of stem cells, injects into the heart, and it works. And he says, I don't care as long as it works. We can figure out the science later. Let's get it work done. And in a way, that's what was done with vaccinations. I mean, certainly when smallpox vaccine came out, nobody knew exactly why it worked. They just did, or they didn't understand the biochemistry of it, rather. And so this is what we're doing here. About. We talked a little bit about where the stem cell sources come from adults, from the bone marrow, umbilical cord blood. Now, the embryonic stem cells, a couple of different sources. With in vitro fertilization, a woman is stimulated so she will make 10, 20 eggs, oocytes. These are retrieved all at the same time. It's nice to do it all at once. Many more embryos are created than can be used. The rest are frozen. Who knows how many frozen embryos are out there in the world? Many years ago, somebody came up with an estimate of 400,000, but nobody knows. There may be an attempt to count them now, but they're just everywhere. Embryos can stay frozen for a long time. When they're thawed, not that many are viable, maybe only a quarter. But it doesn't make any difference how long they've been frozen. That's not the problem. So their cells can be frozen for decades, we think, and still have that 25% chance of thawing out. So you have all these embryos everywhere. Now that sounds like a lot, but when you cut down the number of ones that don't survive and the ones that aren't suitable for other reasons because of the genetic makeup of their parents, you may not have that many. That's one of the debates, how many are there, but there are a lot. Now this is the other real key principle to talk about ethics. Somatic cell nuclear transfer. This is something really to understand, appreciate how things work. The idea here is to remove the nucleus from an oocyte. And this is a microscopic view of this. A glass pipette sucks out the nucleus from an oocyte. then is replaced with a nucleus from a mature cell. Like, you know, scrape your cheek, get a cell from that, take out the nucleus and put it in this oocyte. Then with the proper stimulation, you know, the batch of chemicals that scientists figure out will work, the cells divide and create a blastocyst that we saw earlier. So you have a collection of stem cells. So we, a scientist can now do a very good job making stem cells. And what they've done, of course, is they've created an embryo, this blastocyst, solely for the purpose of research. And now we're getting to really ethical gray zones here. But that's what somatic cell nuclear transfer does. The same thing here, but figures. Mature oocyte, removal of the DNA, the nucleus, injecting a new nucleus from the donor, proper stimulation, cleavage, division, stem cells, that then can be taken out in culture and will continue to grow under the right conditions. Therapeutic cloning is just another name for somatic cell nuclear transfer. Now, one more step up from this is called somatic cell nuclear transfer using embryonic stem cell-derived germ cells. So one more time, we have an enucleated oocyte. Add to that a somatic or mature cell nucleus. Stimulate, divide, stem cells. Then, once again with the right chemicals and the right conditions, these stem cells can be stimulated to become oocytes. You add them to a donor sperm and you can have a normal pregnancy. This is really important because it's the holy grail of infertility treatment is to have a child with DNA from both parents. It's very important. You know, parents can have a donor egg or donor sperm. I mean, they adopt. But parents really want this kid to have genetic material from both parents. This does that. So you have Sarah, as maybe don't get pregnant. Who knows why? You take a nucleus from her cheek, put it in one of these nuclear oocytes, stimulate it just properly. Her husband gives a sample, IVF, mix it in a petri dish, put it back, she has a baby. Now, you think that's fine. That's great, wonderful. A miracle. They have this baby. It represents both of their genetic background. But if you think about it, why does it have to be Sarah and Richard? Can't it be Sam and Richard? And indeed, Oh, this is what I just talked about. It could be Sam and Richard, too. You can have his cheek donors put inside the oocyte, mix it with his sperm, and you have a baby with the genetic combination of the two males. And, of course, two women could do the same thing using techniques that are not that far off. They're doing this with mice now. Who knows? Maybe 5 or 10 years. I don't know. But certainly a huge area of controversy. Yes?
When you're talking about frozen embryos, could you explain what these are and how mature they are?
A lot of times
think at least it's a little miniature baby.
No, there's this blastocyst.
Right.
This blastocyst. Good point. Just this collection of stem cells. Without any differentiation. I'm wrong. No, no. If they're fertilized, they're beyond that. They're ready to be implanted. So they may be 5 or 10, 15 days old. So they're not the day threes. Yeah. But very tiny. It's very difficult. I have a niece that recently went through this. And she has a bunch of frozen embryos. I ask her, do you think about these embryos? What are you going to do with them? You're not going to need them all. And she basically, she doesn't want to talk about it. I mean, it's...
So you're talking about post-gastrulation then?
Yeah.
Days.
Yeah. Now, what are the difficulties in stem cell research? It's hard to get these stem cells to keep on proliferating because you need them to keep on producing. They're in the lab, in the petri dish, whatever. You've got to experiment on them. Experiment fails, you need a new batch. You've got to need new sources all the time. It's very difficult to keep them going. They have contamination, not the right conditions, they die out. With every generation, there's a deterioration. Everything ages. And so after several generations, they're just not the same thing. So you need a new continuing source. Everything mutates. Ultraviolet light, whatever it is that causes it, we mutate. Each generation has mutations introduced into it that may make them unusable. Remember, too much proliferation isn't any good either. That's cancer. Viral contamination, host graft rejection. A lot of cells are grown on animal substrates, and that can introduce problems. So,
is this what is happening with the government-approved lines?
Yeah, all of the government-approved lines, the ones that currently exist, were created from animal substrates. So they're really suboptimal. And also, they're getting old. I mean, they're not going to be any good. I think there's only maybe a dozen of them left now, and they'll soon be gone.
So there's no immune system to keep this line clean?
No. Now we're going to move into ethics here, ethics and theology. I'm going to bring up several ethical principles. I'm not claiming that they're all of the ethical principles that might be involved in stem cell debates, but quite a few. Actually, I need my briefcase. Number one is respect for life. And I think the best example that I've ever read is this example here of a situation in Israel several years ago. There was Orthodox Jewish political prisoners in an Israeli jail, and it begins a hunger strike. With his life in danger, a judge orders force feeding, which wouldn't happen in the West, stating that the preservation of life takes precedence over his dignity. Now I'm going to read from the physician that was taking care of this prisoner. I indicated that we had the will and the ability to feed him even against his will, and that it would be much more pleasant for all concerned if he did not resist being fed through a nasal gastric tube. He asked for time to think it over and shortly thereafter stated his position. He requested assurance that the tube feeding meet his particularly high standards for kosher food, and that he permitted to deposit a letter with copies sent to a list of government authorities indicating that he was being fed against his express wishes, and that I would bear the legal and criminal consequences. When this was accomplished, he offered no resistance and accepted tube feeding under no protest. The conventional Western view says to competent people who wish to end their lives, if that's your autonomous desire, we will not obstruct you in any way. The traditional Jewish view says, you are so valuable to us, beyond what you mean to yourself, that we simply cannot permit you to die. Second ethical principle, human life never used as a means to an end. Because that's the basic reason why slavery is immoral. No, I don't care how the slaves are kept or whether they're happy or sad, they're being used as a means to an end. Similarly, this ethical principle says we cannot buy or sell organs or stem cells. Greatest good for the greatest number, a third ethical principle. Now, anybody read the new Ian McEwan book, Saturday? Okay. It's set in the post-9/11 world just before the Iraqi invasion. Just as a side part of the book, I thought it was interesting that there's the main character and his daughter, his 20-some-year-old daughter, are debating about the war. Although he's a nice British liberal, he still is sort of not sure. He thinks that, you know, and he says, you know, Saddam Hussein killed a lot of people. I know, and his daughter says, but there are going to be thousands killed and well, millions and displaced and refugees. And so they're arguing back and forth, and it's interesting, they're both arguing over numbers, outcomes. And it's basically where are going to be most people die if we invade them or don't invade them? And that's how they carry on this argument. You don't hear anything about it's wrong to have preemptive war, or it's right to encourage democracy that otherwise wouldn't be there. There's no principles, it's all outcome. And that's the greatest good for the greatest number, and it's an ethical principle. The slippery slope. We all play with slippery slopes. We don't have televisions because we're afraid of slippery slope. We don't have caffeine because it's slippery slope to drug addiction. A lot of things that we do, we call slippery slopes. We're worried about what it means for the future. A little bit now, and then it's going to get worse if we start down this slope. Right now, Oregon is facing a real problem with a death row inmate who has renal failure. The state is spending $120,000 a year for dialysis, but he's the candidate for a $100,000 kidney transplant. Now, the state will save money if they give him a kidney transplant, but kidneys are rare. Why use one for a death row inmate? That's a difficult decision. And it's made even worse by the fact that the state health plan is no longer going to provide medication money or money for medication for people with kidney transplants to buy the medicine that they need to keep it for their immune system suppressed. So a lot of state welfare patients can't get kidney transplants. They're not even put on the list because the state won't give them the money that they need to continue with this. But there's no restriction on these medications for inmates. So a lot of citizens have suggested, well, let's just not do it. We've got to make a rule. Well, that, you know, inmates, whatever, can't have these transplants. That's a slippery slope. Because once you start deciding who's worthy or not to get a transplant, based on their criminal record, based on their future for society, based on their age, based on non-medical issues, that's a slippery slope that you really don't want to go down. And in fact, that's what this says. The state is on a slippery ethical slope if it tries to determine who to use for transplant based on things like criminal history. It's a Pandora's box of qualifications that will come up. Finally, autonomy. Autonomy is the right to seek or deny treatment. Given high value in the West, but as I just gave an example in Israel, there are other conflicting issues too. But we think it's, for Americans anyway, autonomy is more important than anything else combined. Now, I'm going to walk through an ethical scientist, how I think an ethical scientist would approach this. Actually, two ethical scientists, one opposing and one supporting stem cell research. In support of stem cell research, the ethical scientists would say that embryos do have a moral status, but it's not that of a human. The opposing scientists would say an embryo cannot be destroyed for research purposes, period, because when you take out these stem cells to put them in a petri dish, the embryo is lost. It's gone, destroyed. So the ethical scientists supporting research will say that, well, embryos are not considered property, so they're not a means to an end. The sources, the parents, retain control, but there is public finding and oversight. Because of the imprinting and the therapeutic cloning, it's not fully alive because you don't have that black box. The blastocyst has all the DNA, but it doesn't have that black box, so maybe it's not life. Respect for life. The ethical scientists will feel a sense of loss of embryo destruction. How do they destroy embryos? Well, some labs just keep them frozen forever, not wanting to face the decision what to do with them. Maybe equipment failure someday will lead to their destruction. Others incinerate them, others let them air dry, flush them down the drain, who knows. Clearly not a lot of talk about it in Washington or anywhere. And the ethical scientists will only use pre-gastrulation embryos. And that's a line that may be important. Others may say it's a silly differentiation. It's an embryo or not. Greatest good for the greatest number. The ethical scientists will say there's no other way to obtain results. There are too many problems with adult stem cells. They may not exist for all cell types. They're difficult, much more difficult to maintain in cell culture lines embryonic stem cells. They tend to differentiate too early. And by the time, we may figure it out eventually. It may be that adult stem cells eventually will work just fine, but maybe we've lost a whole generation of people with disease that could have been helped. So the ethical scientist says it's okay. Now, let's take the ethical scientist who opposes stem cell research. They say human life is never a means to an end. Stem cell research can lead to exploitation of women. You need a lot of egg cells. Can you pay a woman in Bolivia to subject herself to stimulation and retrieve her egg cells? I'm sure she needs the money. And of course, commercial exploitation of stem cell research. Without government oversight, companies need to make, they need a quarterly profit, they need to hurry up research, they need to do things. Big room for a lot of commercial exploitation. Think of stem cell research in the hands of Enron. The ethical scientist who opposes stem cell research says that because of respect for life, you cannot destroy a living embryo for any purpose. Keep getting back to this, but this is the basic line. We describe the greatest number, the ethical scientist said, will say, well, alternatives can provide equal benefit. You can use cord blood, you can use other adult stem cells. Big debate whether they work or not, but the opposing science will say, well, that's where you should put our focus, our research monies in the for these alternatives. And of course, the ethical scientist who opposes stem cell research will get very concerned about slippery slope. Experience with embryonic stem cell research is directly applicable to cloning. Anything that you learn with stem cell research, you can apply to cloning. Nobody wants to go down that path. Stem cell research today, euthanasia tomorrow. This is an article that appeared just a couple of weeks ago from Holland. The Groningen reporter called euthanasia severely ill newborns. And that sounds really scary. You think, what are they doing? You've got a severely newborn. You're causing the death of this newborn just because you think it's not can't live very long. We're talking really, really sick babies who are in constant pain as far as anybody can figure out, who have no hope of living. So it's not quite as draconian as it sounds, but still, for the ethical scientist, this is just an example of a slippery slope. First you get rid of embryos, then very sick babies, then retarded people, then old people, and then Democrats, right? Okay. Now we're going to switch and talk about different religious traditions. Pretty plain for Catholics, fertilization creates human life, period. And it's due all the legal and moral status and rights of any human life. Now there's some fuzziness around the edges here. I went to a lecture once, and I saw somebody worried about, well, if it's a full human life, it needs to be baptized, right? How do you baptize an embryo? Well, this guy said, well, what do you need to baptize? You need water. Well, what does the fetus live in? The amniotic fluid with water. So you just, if you have a woman, and you're worried that her baby's going to die before it gets born, so you can't baptize it because it'll be dead by the time it's born, you just have her move her belly around, and that swishes the water, and then that's the baptism. It's total serious. Jewish tradition, there's a mandate to save human life, and that was what I read about. Human life is just up there, very high. And in the tradition, the embryo has no moral status until 40 days after implantation. Why 40 days? Well, 40 nights, 40 days, 40 years. Everything's 40. Why? A sage thought thinks because there are 40 weeks of gestation. So 40 is, that's the maybe the root of that number. Life begins with birth. Learning is granted at great latitude, so research is encouraged. And so, not surprisingly, Israel accepts embryonic stem cell research. Muslim tradition, there's also a mandate somewhere hidden there in the Quran to save human life. Legal and moral status accorded to fetus after ensoulment, which is at the end of the fourth month of pregnancy. So they're, I don't know, 18, 19 weeks maybe. And so they have a leeway also. And so not surprisingly, Iran's government funds embryonic stem cell research. The evangelical tradition, wanting to use the scriptures as a source of all questions, uses these two verses a lot. And from Psalm 139:3, for you created my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. So there's life before birth. Or from Jeremiah, before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. Of course, a Mormon missionary will say, oh, let me explain to you what these mean. But to the evangelicals, it means that's a living life there. Embryo, fetus, whatever. Latter-day Saint tradition. From Joseph Smith, I teach them correct principles. That's nice. That gives us a chance to decide for ourselves. The eternal nature of the spirit existing before birth, that creates a whole lot. Eternal progression technology, I can't overemphasize the importance of technology here in Mormon thought. We love technology. We're Americans. Americans love technology anyway. But Mormons and eternal progression, be therefore perfect, that's what technology is, right? I gave a really abbreviated version of this at a priesthood quorum that I teach. And I was very surprised that everybody there said, yeah, we're for it. Stem cell research, great. I thought there'd be some hesitation. They loved the technology of it. Partly because there's a visitor there who was from some place in Oregon where he has a farm, and he was talking about all the things he does to his cattle. All the IVF and the sperm this and the cloning this. And so the class said, well, great, see how it works? So I think technology is really important. Respect for life. And this, I love this story. We all hear it, but I think I'm going to read it because it's nice to get the original. From the Joseph Smith Journal, Zion's Camp. In pitching my tent, we found three misogalas, or prairie rattlesnakes, which the brethren were about to kill, but I said, let them alone, don't hurt them. How would a serpent ever lose his venom while the servants of God possess the same disposition and continue to make war upon it? Men must become harmless before the brute creation. And when men lose their vicious dispositions and cease to destroy the animal race, the lion and the lamb can dwell together and the sucking child can play with the serpent in safety. So a nice little moral lesson on respect for life, wherever it is. Paraphrasing from the Book of Mormon, it is better that one embryo should perish than a whole nation of diabetics and Alzheimer's be allowed to die prematurely. Greatest good for the greatest number. Brigham Young thought that life came to that the spirit came to the body at quickening, about 20 weeks. J. Rupin Clark gave a speech at BYU in which he implied, he didn't say it directly, but he implied the spirit does not enter the fetus much before birth. At the time, he was Counselor David on the case. I don't know whether it was a joint decision on their part. They didn't always agree, so I don't know whether you could say that, but that's as far as we get there.
Where's the reference for that?
It's a book I left at home. It's a talk he gave to some seminary teachers at BYU.
Does this mean proven error way back when?
No, it's a speech that he gave. And I don't think it was ever printed outside of the speech. But it was... I'm sorry. I'm really sorry for what happened. Yes?
For a person giving a similar talk, I was researched all the statements of the life began and all the materials I had. It was 100 references. And quickening is often used
No, I'm saying he was president when J. Rupin Clark made this talk, so maybe it had his approval. Sorry, what? Yes. You have two ways of approaching it. One is, Bruce R. McConkie had an extended answer to this, and basically said, we don't know. We just don't know, and we don't know. I mean, you can say, well, do they do temple work on miscarriages or stillborns? No.
And there you say, well, and then Brigham Young referred to that. And he said, don't worry, it'll be taken care of. Don't do temple work, but they'll be taken care of, implying that it was, that there will be resurrected stillborns. But then he was dealing mainly with stillborns. You know, the fully formed baby that dies at birth, which is very common in the 1800s. But there's a continuum with miscarriages. I mean, how many miscarriages are there? There are billions. I mean, maybe 1/4 to 1/3 of all pregnancies ended in miscarriage. Maybe sort of the woman doesn't know she has it. Are all these going to be resurrected someday? To quote somebody else, the thought makes reason stare. Yeah.
Well, I have a personal experience. When our third daughter was born, I was present at the birth, and it was like a light switch was turned on in the delivery room. Just at the time of her birth, it was plain as, I cannot tell you how dramatic it was. It may have been me, but I was never, it hasn't happened with any of the other children.
Yes.
This is a point that we discussed a while ago. But he talked about the urge to let the very old and things die. This is traditionally what's happened to the history of the world. Doctors either, a lot of, but, you know, without heroic efforts, usually out of compassion assisted a severely deformed or terribly ill child.
I mean, once again, I'm intruding here on something that I should know, but I have to know that even though the Catholic tradition is very strong about you know, Schiavo case and all that, you prolong life as much as you can, the Pope didn't go to the hospital. He could have. And he could have been living today, maybe intubated and everything else. He made a decision to let go and to stay in his quarters and not go to the hospital. It was his decision. That he made. Okay, we just talked about this. We got to move on here. Now, this is a statement. What? I'm sorry. You want to go back?
Yeah.
Well, we didn't talk about it.
We didn't talk about
this. This sort of folklore, not written anywhere, but you hear about it. And this is the other side of it. The Brigham Young said, "Don't worry about these children; they'll be resurrected." You hear this in folklore that if there is one of these events, God will provide another opportunity for the spirit to be joined in the physical body.
Get back in line.
Yeah, get back in line. And I'm sure you hear about people who decide to have another children after miscarriage, another child, just because they think that there's a spirit waiting. Yes?
Just one really quick thing. Can we say that the concept of the baby's alive, the quickening is ridiculous one because babies have been moving around a long time?
Of course. And that's why you don't hear, that's why you hear a lot in 1800s literature, but now you don't hear that at all. No one says that anymore. Yes? Oh, you had your hand up or you're just stretching? Okay. It's sold.
In the 60s, my mission president told the story of when he had a stillborn child and was not satisfied with this folklore that the church did not require that you keep track of that on your genealogical records or do any temple work. So he called the phone number that Joseph Fielding Smith used to have where you could call and answer. And he said to the person, you know, the clerk who, young woman who was answering the phone, I'm not satisfied with the official answer that she gave him. May I speak with President Smith himself? And so he was put through, and he said to President Smith, I understand in the case of stillborn that we're not supposed to keep track of that information, and I'm not satisfied with that. And he said that President Smith said, what? That's our official answer?
What?
I don't believe that. You should keep track of that information, and you should consider it as a child that you would have. So that, I mean, what do you say to that?
But once again, like you talk about the continuum of movement, there's a continuum of life. I mean, stillborn at 40 weeks, 32, 28, miscarriage at 18 weeks, miscarriage at 5 weeks, miscarriage at 1 week. I mean, at what point do you...
Okay. This was an example of even President Smith not believing or not accepting the folklore that was officially documented.
Now, we do have a recent statement, not on when life begins, but on stem cell research. The church made this statement in 2001 in response to, this is when Bush first came out with his limitation of stem cell research to current lines, with no extra stem cell lines created.
That Joseph Fielding Smith?
Yes. Yeah. So stem cell research merits cautious scrutiny. As with any emerging new technology, there are concerns that must be addressed. Scientific and religious viewpoints both demand that strict moral ethical guidelines be followed.
That's a statement.
No, no, it teaches us correct principles and we can govern ourselves. Now, Russell Nelson is a heart surgeon and says it very plain. But, you know, it doesn't really answer anything. And it certainly doesn't answer things for politicians. Senator Smith of Oregon has come up with a conclusion based on Genesis 2:7. And the Lord God formed a man of the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a soul. He says, well, there's obviously two steps there. Man is formed of dust, and then there's the breath of life. A two-step process means creation of a body followed by the interest of the spirit. So therefore, he thinks that he can justify embryonic stem cell research, and he votes for it. All five Mormon senators are in favor of it. Yeah.
How many instances of combinations of germ cells actually can result in a viable pregnancy?
Well, nobody knows. But
very few.
So it's a huge number.
All these, probably 90% or more of those combinations end up going by the wayside somehow.
Well, I don't know, 90, but it's a huge number. It's a huge number.
And that's life in the very beginning. Most of it never happened.
Yep, huge. And then our beloved Senator Hatch. And this is a statement made just a couple of days ago, because again, it's come up and it'll be before Congress in a few weeks. I have never believed that life begins in a petri dish. One of the best ways to be pro-life is to help the living. What? Go ahead, what?
No, it says two opposite
things. No. He supports embryonic stem cell research because he doesn't believe that embryos are a living human being. No. Now, I'd like to go through, and trying to close up here, a few viewpoints. And the first, asking some questions, how important is this debate? This some essayist wrote, the current debate is no less than a defining moment in the history of how we are to understand the meaning of living as human beings. I disagree with that. In the world in which 4 million non-combatants die in the Congo, 2 million in the Sudan, and in a world in which rape is used as a means of war, that's important. This is just for these rich Westerners who want to have babies with their own DNA. So I don't think it's that important. I'm sort of playing devil's advocate there, but you know, it may not be that important. Number two, can we know when life begins? I mean, it's so important for something. When does the spirit enter the body? Like there's 1 second, like this flash of light and the spirit's there. Let me go back, no, not go back, but sidetrack to quantum mechanics. Now, Newtonian physics gets us to the moon and back, builds airplanes and skyscrapers, but it does a crummy job of understanding the atom. Quantum mechanics does that. And this is the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, saying that you can't know both the position and the speed of an object at the same time. You can know the position, but then you can't know the speed because the process of measurement affects the other. Maybe it's the same idea for when life begins. Why does it have to be a split second in time? Time is relative. So let's not get too hung up on when does life begin, or when does life end? It's a continuum, it's uncertainty, it's all probability. Ethical framework. First of all, you got to decide, are you an outcome person or a sanctity of life person? Because that's going to make a big difference. And finally, evolving ethics. Things change. Justice Scalia notwithstanding, things change. Transplantation was once rejected as a mutilation of the body. There have been huge changes in the view of contraception, the morality of contraception. Now, I've talked about ethics and science. I just thought I ought to spend 1 slide on the politics of embryonic cell research. So you can decide where you are and who you align with. If you don't want ever to do stem cell research, embryonic stem cell research, you're there with Benedict the 16th, the new Pope, and Representative Delaney. If you only want to use current cell lines, which are rapidly dying out, you're with President Bush. If you only want to use discarded embryos from in vitro fertilization, you're there with Mitt Romney, whose wife has multiple sclerosis, so it's a big issue for him. But if you want to use all pre-gastrulation embryos, then you're there with Hatch. So pick your company. Now, the emotions, which may be for most people really the bottom line. Christopher Reeve said, I have no doubt I can be cured. I have virtually no doubt that I could walk again as my injury is confined in one very small area. It's my big chance. And I think that it's the emotions that drive, not ethics, not religion, maybe politics, but it's mainly emotion. Now, we didn't talk much about cloning, but I have one statement to make. What makes cloning appealing is because we want to clone because we think we can do a better job of raising ourselves than our parents did. Now, please comment. Any other comments? Yes.
Yeah, if you're on the end of the mic.
What?
Yes.
Oh,
okay.
Yes.
I wonder if anyone else besides me has thought of the question, the huge social problem you would create by declaring in law that life begins at conception. We have laws against child endangerment. Even a small degree of endangerment is illegal. You can't leave a child even briefly in a car while you go into a store. You can't leave a child at home while you go to the pharmacy to buy medicine for the sick child because, you know, the house might catch fire. Very small chance. But we have these laws that prohibit even small dangers to a child. If we take those laws and apply them to the moment of conception, it means the mother can do nothing that produces even a slight chance, in slight increased chance of miscarriage, which means there will be no more working pregnant women. If you look at the 19th century royalty, the women, the queens, the princesses, were very pampered when pregnant, and they had a much significantly larger number of boys to girls because boy embryos are more delicate than girl embryos and die more readily. And if you pamper the mother very much, increase number of boys. So it's definitely known that pampering the mother, not letting her work, not letting her, you know, just treating her like a queen, it reduces the chance of miscarriage. And under child endangerment, you'd have to treat all pregnant women that way, and you would create huge problems. Any woman who might be pregnant, in fact, would have to be treated that way. And has anyone else brought up this idea? It's obvious to me, yes. We have politicians talking about passing a law, maybe even a constitutional amendment, to declare that life begins at conception with full legal rights for the conceived embryo.
Yeah, I think in California, we have a case of a pregnant woman being killed and the person charged with two murders.
That's because Bates was post viability.
That was,
Patterson. The Utah woman that was on drugs, but the story on that was, she was.
There's certain kind of laws against a pregnant woman to smoke, regardless of how far along the
ground. Yeah, we need.
No, it's a huge problem if you carry these ideas to their logical conclusion. Yes.
Well, I was just wondering, I've thought if you apply sort of a legal remuneration for fetus destruction, let's say by accident. This is a tort case. You caused a fetus to abort at 2 weeks. How much would that be worth in the court of law? At 4 weeks, at 8 weeks, and so on. And you, at 2 weeks, you probably get nothing. At 6 months, you would probably get something. And at birth, you'd get something else. And if you, you know, caused the death of a high-earning 30-year-old, you get a lot. So I think, you know, our legal system grades life certainly on a scale, and it isn't uniform. I'm just wondering how that sits with morality and ethics.
Did you happen to mention what the position of Senator Frist was? Would you repeat the question?
The question was the position of Senator Frist.
Yeah, you had various people, white rights begins.
I don't know what he would say to that when life begins, but I think he'd probably say that in one sense of the word, life begins at birth, at conception for him. At least that's what he wants people to think that he believes.
I've heard people say that he understands the utility, the really importance of stem cell research, but it's kind of a political position that he's taking, anticipating running for office in a certain climate.
He opposes abortion because, I mean, it's, yeah.
So this is a quote from the Washington Post. Last summer, Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist, a physician, said he thought the Bush policy should be revisited after election day. The implication, according to Cass and others, was that Frist hoped to broaden it. Now Frist is not certain that it would be possible in a new, more Republican Senate, said one advisor who could not be quoted.
Now, as his presidential ambitions increase, though, he's becoming more conservative in his view of life. Yeah.
There are plenty of people that are starting a movement doing an end run around the life debate by talking about potential life. This, you know, this embryo or blastula has potential life. It must be protected. You know, whether you believe it has life or not, that will go all the way.
And, well, it's certainly, I mean, let's not go too far here. I mean, there has to be some respect afforded this these stem cells. I mean, remember, one of the ethical conclusions was that there should be some mourning at the loss of embryos. I mean, does that mean every day at noon we pause for 15 seconds to mourn all the embryos that are lost? I don't know what that means, but you have to. But in a practical sense, I think what it means is that you keep things controlled. It's not a buy and sell. It's not a commercial product. It's equal to all people. I mean, there's a lot of ways to show respect for the embryonic life without having to protect it in all those ways, yeah.
I want to switch sides to a comment that you made about, wait a minute, this is hyper-technology for the super-rich Western society. Could the same money be better spent improving the lifestyle of people in the third world and the greater good for the greater number be there, and therefore you just ban up this stuff. It's a waste of money. Notwithstanding, some people might live to 90 or 95 years.
Yeah, the question was, in terms of the greatest good for the greatest number, can't the money being spent on stem cell research be spent for health in the third world, basically, and get more
first world, presently living,
yeah, and save more lives, maybe. I don't know. Yeah, Camille. Right, I mean, there's a trickle-down theory that's probably real. I mean, we wouldn't have Teflon frying pans without the space program. So we all benefit eventually from this. And I think there would be a lot of.
But we're talking about having the ethical issue about killing less. That's the difference I can see between the prior research. I'm all in favor of technology killing people.
Yep.
Technically, if you throw skin to burn victims, isn't that life? Isn't that a living tissue?
Well, it's living tissue, but it's not a human life.
But this other is not a human life either. It's potential life.
Yeah.
The difference is whether or not they're differentiated, because stem cells aren't yet differentiated. They could become the person.
The embryo, this blastocyst that we're destroying by taking out its inner core, could become a living person. This patch of skin cells never can.
Well
but it, but you might say, but it could in the right conditions, because you could.
Yes,
yeah,
it's,
yeah.
The blastocyst could not, in the future, become a living person.
And that's that uniqueness is what makes a lot of, drives a lot of the argument about the blastocyst. It needs to be protected because it's unique. Once the oocyte and the sperm get together, there's now a unique combination, unique in all the world. And yet all those skin cells are the same as other skin cells. So that uniqueness is a big issue. Yes. Yes.
One question.
When you have two men each donating their DNA, they're donating both an X and a Y. So they have X's in there with the mitochondrial DNA. So they could have either boy or girl. Now, if you have two women, they're only going to have a daughter out of this. But these two guys could have a man or a
woman. Mitochondrial DNA is from the donor egg.
Mitochondria is not in the nucleus. You're just taking out the nucleus from this donor egg. You're leaving the rest of it there.
Point of clarification on embryonic cells or stem cells. Are these stem cells identical to the embryonic cells before gastrulation? Or
yes. Yeah, that's
they really are. So in other words, adults have stem cells that haven't undergone any differentiation at all?
Correct. Yep.
Ooh, but that's
they duplicate themselves. Yeah.
Then you could do nuclear transplants or whatever on those stem cells, adult stem cells.
If you can find them, they're harder. They're harder to find. These are adult stem cells.
But they're rare, I take it, stem cells. They're more common?
Well, maybe a little bit more, but they still have some of the problems where they're harder to maintain in a cell line generation after generation, which may be a technical problem that can be overcome, maybe not.
Would you comment on the impact of the proposition
I'm not from California. I mean, I don't know. It's just giving a lot of money for stem cell research, right? For embryonic stem cell research.
That's right.
Yeah.
They're going to borrow a lot of money.
Well, that's what's got Mitt Romney at odds with his legislature in Massachusetts, because Harvard doesn't want to lose out. And so the supporters of Harvard and MIT and whatever, they want Massachusetts to approve a similar funding measure, or at least make it legal. And Romney doesn't want to do anything beyond the discarded embryos from in vitro fertilization. But they think, the last thing I read was, they think they have enough votes to overcome a veto. Because they don't want to lose the money. This is business now. This is business. Yeah.
If you're into this, the area of politics, money, and you start comparing the NIH, which provides Harvard, Stanford, UCSF, and various universities, versus what the California proposition provides, which is like 70-some million dollars.
I mean, it's $3 billion.
$3 billion. But what could NIH produce as much funding as each individual area with their own local bill like this committed to borrow?
Yeah, I don't know, but I mean, there's a huge, I mean, the NIH budget is huge. And I don't, go ahead, what?
I happen to work at the grant unit at UCSF, which works extensively with NIH. We can't do it. This block is a country. Until Congress releases money, it's all California money. NIH cannot distribute money to the service.
But it's a feeling.
No, NIH will not fund it.
But if Orrin Hatch and his colleagues are successful, and they also think they may have enough votes to overcome a filibuster, they think they have close to 60 senators in favor of embryonic stem cell research. Is the feeling that, from what you know, that would unleash a huge amount of money, or more than California?
So, NIH really drastically underfunded. So here all the time, the grants are being cut by between 20%. This administration is not pro research. And so we're really scrambling for grant money. But so I don't think that the floodgates would open, but any little bit helps. And certainly, I know you did that from frontline with every bill, trying to get the money in San Francisco for research. We don't have a sense of how much would be available. Certainly, they're not going to, even if they approve stem cell research, they're not going to fund more money for it. They're just going to stop vetoing it.
Which might be real important, because I think that a lot of researchers have multiple grants, and they don't want any restrictions, because they may, you know, if you have one grant that's restricted, and that applies, then it gets very messy over who's what you can do.
I can tell you that the best stem cell people are now working in England, which freed up stem cell research long soon.
Yeah.
There was a huge outflow of them,
brain. And that's part of the argument, the political argument now. I think we're way over time now, but thank you. We do? Okay, I'm sorry. Yes. This is not the question was about the frozen embryos left over from IVF. No one talks about it at all.
Are Catholics in favor of or against IVF?
Against IVF.
So
Catholics are against condoms. I mean, there's just nothing you can do. Yeah. No, totally against IVF.
So that, okay, but other than that, that still raises essentially the same issue, right?
Destroying potential life. It does. And that's why some IVF people just keep them frozen forever. Don't have to worry about it. And maybe if electricity goes out someday and they die, oh well, but at least they didn't make the decision. Yes?
I'm a member of the Community of Christ here observing, and gave a paper earlier, and so this is fascinating to me, because I would never have imagined that I hadn't paid any attention that five Mormon senators to some degree were in favor of stem cell research, or that there's some positive opinion about it from some church leaders. Do you have a sense, though, of rank and file Mormons? Whether is it an issue that the church is split on?
Well,
do they tend to agree with the leaders, or does anybody here have a sense of that?
The question is, rank and file Mormons, what they feel about it. I have two comments on that, and once again, one from Orrin Hatch, that when he made this statement that I had up there, part of his statement was, as I go through Utah, I have people saying to me all the time, you're on the right path, Orrin, you're on the right path. So he feels like he's getting a lot of positive support in Utah. And the other is my one little, my priesthood quorum class that I taught this lesson to, they all said, yeah, sounds good to me. So I don't think you'll get a lot of opposition to embryonic stem cell research from the average Mormon.
Until some GA says something. It's wonderful that everyone is smart.
Yes, but the minute a GA does that, then they're directly contradicting Orrin Hatch and the other high political, and that's, I don't think they want to do that.
But they do. So,
well,
they are so right-wing in the thinking. They're going to follow the right-wing Protestant evangelical line to the death without thinking about what they're doing.
Well, it hasn't happened yet. It hasn't happened yet.
I'm kind of interested in the community of Christ position. Is there a single position?
No. We don't have a single position on anything. I would hazard a guess that it's probably fairly even split along liberal conservative lines on the same. I mean, those who voted for Bush because the queers are coming probably aren't going to want stem cell research, and those of us who are gay friendly are certainly wishing that we could free up money to get this on the road. So
it's quite diverse.
It's a very diverse.
Well, we certainly want to thank Brother Hunter for this discussion. When I was preparing for this, the one thing I recalled two incidents. Like one, when I was in college, I read about the Donner Party and the fact that some of the people survived because they ate the remains of some of their fellow members of the Donner Party and how they were condemned. And then I remember reading the story of this soccer team in I think it was Chile that was in this airplane that crashed, and the survivors, remains of those that were killed, and they justified it in terms of what better contribution did these members who had died to make to my survival when they were not going to survive. Thank you very much.
Thanks.